So, this is a general Q&A. So it's basically people type in their comments if they want to make a comment, and I'll try and answer the questions. We've got one
Got one
already
question in a
from
minute,
Peter
yeah.
Newell. I'll need to look at that again though, because
Well, I'll tell you what,
it's quite a
Peter.
protracted
It is. Can
quite a protracted
you just
question.
move your board round so that people can see a bit more of the board towards you and that?
That's it.
Is that better?
Yeah, sort of. The board, by the way, the whiteboard, that the idea behind that is at some point somebody might ask a question on a line or
Well, let's
some
look at a chicane. Can you draw me a
chicane.
chicane? Because Peter,
Yes, Peter's asked about a chicane. Yes, that's quite true.
it says
A
it's a
little
little
blurry.
blurry. Do you want to try and go to one of the Wi-Fi channels then?
Hang on a second, Peter. It might just be a bit of that. I don't know. Still blurry?
You want to pick up on one of the Wi-Fi channels as well then? Because I don't know if it's
What, click on the top?
Looks fast enough to me on here, but you go to
Right.
the BT one.
BT. That's at the 36X3. Or it's the J3JF, isn't it? Sorry, we're having issues, Peter.
Right, let's draw a chicane, please, for Peter Newell.
Right, well, if you're listening, Peter,
It is,
you
it's
might not
there.
be able to see it. However, there's a lot of generalization you have to put into this, because there's a million scenarios that you can put into this sort of thing. You could even say something like the gooseneck at Cadwell Park is kind of a chicane, because it's two corners linked by virtually no straight. The end of one corner is the start of the next, so that's kind of a chicane.
But the question is getting on the power while
Yes, let me
exiting the
get there.
chicane.
So obviously the voice you can hear, by the way, is Jennifer, my other half. If you've never met her, she is the force behind me in many ways. Yes, but the chicane, better, good. The chicane issue is a bit of how long is a piece of string, because the for instance is speed of the entry. The distance between the two apexes, the right to the left or the left to the right, whichever it is, how condensed they are. For instance, if we're talking at Cadwell Park, for instance, you've got the actual chicane itself, which is just before the bottom of the mountain, and the distance between the two apexes there is virtually no time at all. There's no straight as such. So where you pick the throttle up there is completely different as going through. For argument's sake, if you think the gooseneck is a chicane, is you're picking up the throttle at a completely different point.
Right, well, it feels like he's not getting on the gas early enough to match his drive out of the corner.
Yes, but it's all relevant to
Let's
the
draw
type of
something, can you?
chicane.
I've got a big whiteboard in front of me and nothing's
My
happening.
wife's shouting at me to draw something, so let's draw something. The gooseneck, not the gooseneck, let's talk about the chicane at the bottom of the mountain. Your gooseneck video was perfect. Yeah, well, hopefully you did see that, and that hopefully explains a little bit, even though it's not, in many people's eyes, isn't viewed as a chicane. However, in my eyes, any two corners which are that close together effectively are. So the chicane at the just before the bottom of the mountain, for me, is a more, as it were, traditional viewed chicane. The thing which really helps all of this is about perspective, in the sense that what your eye sees as to what is actually going on underneath you can be very, very different sometimes. And what helps always in them situations for me to gain perspective is looking at an aerial shot, say through Google Maps, and that really does kind of open up what the eye doesn't and does see. For instance, when you come out of Mansfield and you're racing up towards the chicane, your eyes are sort of drawn basically down the track, and you're turning off the track into this little tiny corridor, which is the chicane. So what a lot of people tend to do is to get rid of all the speed more or less before they turn right, or as they're turning right. So their speed past the first apex is already the speed that they're going to go around the left, which is the first major mistake. Because if you look at the aerial shot of,
Can you give me a diagram of it?
yes, let me get there, dear. If you look at the aerial shot of that the chicane going in there. The track width as you're running down towards the chicane is probably 7 meters, maybe 8 meters. It's quite a wide track, but as it goes through the chicane, you're down to sort of a maximum, I would say, of 4 meters, probably as little as 3 meters when it goes left. So it's a real kind of funnel. So what I tend to do is if you can try to imagine, again, this is hand drawn, so you bear with me on this one. You've got essentially the straight, if you will, or the curve running down towards the bottom of the mountain. So we've gone around Mansfield, you've come out of Mansfield, and then you kind of generally make your way across to the left-hand side of the track, ready to go into the chicane. Now, the chicane itself is an add-on bit, which, again, this isn't a great draw diagram of it, but essentially, you're talking that. So that's sort of what the eye sees when you're coming down there. You see the whole width of the track, which is a bit of a false illusion, but you know that you've got to go down this little narrow corridor, but you've got your first apex and your second apex, which is literally, in time, it's probably less than half a second. It's such a small spectrum of time you've got to deal with. So what I tend to do is I move over to the left-hand side of the track, and I create, instead of like going down the middle and doing a tight turn and then creating a next, an equally tight turn, so you've got like a tight right, tight left, which means that at this point in the track, you've got rid of a lot of speed. For me, miles too much speed, and you're really twiddling your thumbs waiting to get to this next bit where you can start your drive out. So what I tend to do is, and if you've got my guide of Cadwell Park, it explains it visually much better, is I move over to the left-hand side of the track and create a much bigger arc. Not quite over that side of the track though, a much bigger arc. So I can travel much faster through here. It means that the braking is slightly different. Where you would normally brake in a very condensed band and then more or less finish your braking and turn in, what I tend to do is brake not as hard, but I stretch the braking out slightly. So I'm still braking all the way to where the bike goes left. So I actually pass the right a first apex, probably traveling too fast. And then as the bike's coming upright, I then do the last bit of death braking. And then as the bike goes left, finally dump the brakes. But literally in the middle of the track there, where the bike's in its transition, that's I'm still braking really hard. And I generally tend to brake almost to the apex of the corner. And literally, as the bike goes on its side into the corner, I kind of dump the brakes and immediately pick the throttle up just to balance the bike. Because if you've broke all the way to that point, even if it's trail brake, there's still a lot of weight on the front wheel, and you all of a sudden, in a very short space of time coming out the corner, want to get a load of weight on the back of the bike by accelerating. That transition can upset the bike and cause all sorts of problems. So the earlier you can pick the throttle up, and it's like, obviously off brakes, pick the throttle up, don't delay, more or less pick the throttle up and immediately start the development of the throttle out the corner. And that the picking the throttle up allows the bike to sort of balance itself, so the weight's sort of more evenly distributed. It improves the amount of grip you've got then, because you've actually put some weight on the back wheel. Because if you go from no weight at all and immediately kind of snap the throttle open, on a lot of bikes, the wheel can actually start to spin up before it's transferred the weight. So getting the weight onto the wheel, the back wheel, and then that's where the picking the throttle up happens, and then developing the throttle as you come out out through and out of the corner. But what a lot of people do, as I say, is they get rid of all the speed by here, and then they run through the corner. Now, for me, one of the biggest restrictions going through a chicane is how physically quickly you change direction from right to left or left to right, whichever way it is. And what a lot of people do is they slow down to a pace they're comfortable changing direction, which is a limiting factor. So the faster you go through the chicane, you have to then match how quickly you change direction. It sounds obvious, but the amount of people I see when I'm following them, how they basically slow down far too much, so a speed that they know they can change direction, but it's sort of wasting a bit of time in this midsection here. But this is just Cadwell Park. Your question, Peter, was more about coming out of the corner. I'm guessing the transition between picking the throttle up leaving the apex behind you, and how, I'm assuming it's how hard you get on the throttle and how quickly you develop the throttle. If for instance, you say if it is the chicane that you're coming out of here, literally from if the bike from the being on its side comes up really quickly, you can develop the throttle really quickly to match it. If, say, coming out of the gooseneck, the bike comes up a lot slower over a longer period of time, you have to develop the throttle more predictably, you know, more progressively coming out the corner. So a lot of it is down to if you sort of sit the bike up and you're still halfway down the rev range and there's still loads of revs to go and you're already upright and close to the sort of drift out point, you might need to either be traveling faster past the apex or maybe even be in a lower gear so that you're carrying slightly more revs maybe, so that the bike is able to develop quicker coming out the corner. It's a question, it's a subject really, I need more meat on the bones, I need to talk to you about it a little bit more.
Could have a personalised phone call.
A personalised phone call,
or one of our new virtual track walk.
Virtual track walk, that would help, I suppose.
Well, we've had another question.
So we'll hopefully that some of that might help, Peter, but to flesh it out properly, I really need more info about what you're feeling, where you're going, what bikes we're on, all that sort of thing. All of it has an effect.
The next message is from Paul Firth. Hello, Paul. What do you think about the Mini Twins as a racing class, and have you coached many Mini Twin races?
Mini Twins, brilliant class. Main reason is it's heavily policed. And there's very strict regulations what you're allowed to do and not to do. So all the bullshit about his bike's faster than mine is kind of nullified, because they're all, you know, you can't do an awful lot to them anyway. You get an out-of-the-box bike, more or less, put a pipe on it, a little bit of twiddling, and you're kind of there, more or less. I get irritated when people say, oh, it's a great starter class. Bugger that, I've been racing 39 years, and if I had a Mini Twin and I could go and race tomorrow, I would enjoy riding it, because it's a great class. The speed that you can get on what is effectively a 650 twin commuter bike is incredible. I think the lap record around Cadwell Park is a high 36, which is motoring in anything really. So, you know, they're a very capable machine, and I absolutely love them. You can do all the learning for whatever bike you're going to ride. But to be honest, it's a bike you could do an entire career on. And I've coached quite a few people on twins. I've done quite a bit of racing on Mini Twins. And it's a bit like Super Monos to me, the Mini Twin class. I have a great love for it and great class to get involved with. So I hope that answers your question, Paul. And by the way, your T-shirts are going in tomorrow's post with a bit of luck.
Right, Mark Ellery's got in touch. He says,
hello, Mark.
How do you regain confidence? He fell at Cascades at Oulton Park a few years ago, and he's never felt comfortable going through Cascades since.
Cascades. Tricky one, that, to be honest. Wet or dry has an effect on your confidence. Cascades is a really peculiar corner, full stop. Very high speed approach going through Denton's.
Could I have a drawing of that?
No, it's too bad. Very high speed approach going through Denton's. You've got the going over the rise, so the bike's kind of light. It'd be really interested if you just drop us a quick answer to this question. Where was it? Was it on the right going through Denton's coming upright, which a lot of people would go down there? Or was it in the transition, still on the brakes, you lost the front immediately? Or was it much more deeper into the corner? All of that can help to identify a problem. The favourite there, the most common crash there is you go through Denton's, which is that little right kink past the Marshall's post on your right. And at that point is generally where most people are sort of starting to brake. Because the bike's at an angle of lean, you can't go like super hard immediately, but it's hard, but not super hard. It's not like you're braking into a straight line into a chicane, for instance. So you can brake pretty damned hard. Where I do the majority of the serious braking is as the bike comes upright. I'm kind of brake hard, and as the bike comes upright, I go to as hard as I'm going to brake at that point. The timing of that normally coincides with there's a small dip in the track, a kind of a little kind of a dent in the track.
He's replied now if that might help. It was in the dry,
yeah,
and it was in transition between the turn in and the apex.
Oh, right. So you're quite deep into the corner. Right. Well, let me finish the thing. I'm braking in that sort of that little dip, if you can picture where that is, really hard there. A lot of people try and get over to the extreme right-hand side of the track. I don't think there's much point in that, really. I'm sort of, at this point, in fact, my perfect line is almost mid-track in that transition. It's not worth trying to get too far over to the right, because that takes away speed that you can go through Denton's. And because the corner's quite long, you know, it's a steady peel in there. But what a lot of people do is they basically hang on to the brake too long with too much lean. Now, if you've hung onto the brake and hung onto the brake, even if you're going too fast and you get into a point where if you're at a knee dangle, if your knees are on the floor regularly, just before your knee goes down at that point, if you're still really hard on the brakes at that point, you're pretty much asking for trouble. The trailing of the brake, even if you're going too fast, dump the brakes, start to get rid of the brakes, and you want to be well off the brakes before you get to the apex. Now, the apex of this corner is quite a long way down the hill. It's, if you ever do a track walk, the Arncourt barrier on your left-hand side is pretty constant radius running around the inside of the corner, and then it a bit kind of sticks out where the marshals can get bikes in around the side. On a lot of circuits, they paint it orange or something like that, so it's a standout feature. I don't think they have it at Cadwell, at Bolton. But that where that juts out, that kind of in your eye, you kind of see the Armco kind of doing that. I'm not really looking at it, but you see it. And that's the point where I sort of get up to the apex. And it, now the track at that point is not level. It only really levels out more or less at the exit. So it's still slightly dropping down at that point, but it's quite late round the corner. If you've gone into the really hot and really fast, the temptation is to get the bike sat up a little bit early and try and get rid of a bit more speed. Well, that's a good thing in one sense. It's a bad thing, that sitting up early, because, of course, you effectively get to the apex too early, which means you can end up over-leaning or leaning for too long, still on the brakes to try to get the bike to turn left. So it's a subject you really need to flesh out. How do you get your confidence back? Well, if that's a confidence issue, if it's just at that one corner, try to break down your riding of what you're doing there. What bike you're on can be affected there. But I mean, I was racing a TZR 250 there 5 or 6 years ago, and you were flat out through Denton's and you kept it absolutely pinned until the bike was upright before going left. And then it was only a short amount of hard braking and a little bit of a trail, and you were into the corner, because your entry speed up to Denton's isn't very quick, really. Where on a superbike, the BSB guys, they keep them pinned almost at the marshals post, just at sort of the apex of Denton's. Now they've got to get rid of another 30, 40 mile an hour in that short space of time. So the braking and that transition is the really important part. I'm guessing you probably hung onto the brake that little bit too long. That's a guess, of course, because I really don't know. How you get confidence back is make sure what you're doing, make sure you're on the right trajectory and your line is pretty good and that you're confident on your approach. Braking is the thing. Make sure you're comfortable in your braking area, comfortable when you apply it, how hard you apply, and in this situation where you start off not so hard and then you can build up and then off, it's like a weird shaped curve if you have a pressure chart of your braking.
Can I have that on a diagram?
No. So what you're doing with the lever at this point, but the confidence issue is more about breaking your riding down so that you at different points on the track you're doing more accurate, more repeatable situations. If you find you can quite comfortably come on the throttle before you get to the apex, so you're probably not running down the hill fast enough, so you've got a bit more room there. If you feel that you're starting to run out of confidence coming in towards the curb, the apex curb on the left, if you're still running out of confidence and you run past that and you sort of drift out into the track a little bit before you come on the throttle, you'll probably find you need to sort of maybe back it off a little bit and try and time it so that you pick the throttle up just as you're coming into the apex of the corner. But because you've still got a fair way round the corner to go, it's one of those tiny bit of maintenance throttle. You pick the throttle just to get it stable, and then sort of as the straight starts to open out, you then start rolling it on out of the corner. But again, what bike you're on makes a difference there as well. More modern superbikes, which you've got, you know, fantastic traction control systems, you can be a bit more liberal with the throttle coming out there. If you're riding something with no traction control on, you must be much more progressive with the throttle, so you don't get that, because you're at full lean till you're almost out to the curb. It's a fantastic corner, but a scary one at the same time. So getting your confidence back is about making sure the line that you're on is correct. What you're doing on those reference points, you know, where you shut the throttle, where you're tipping in, where you're apexing, where you're picking the throttle up, sort of play about a little bit with them to see what feels most comfortable. But generally speaking, if you're picking the throttle up before the apex, you're not going fast enough, or you're finding it comfortable. And if you're finding it comfortable, that probably means there's a bit more pace to be had. But go in small steps. Don't think, okay, I'm going to go down there and an extra 10, 15 mile an hour, because you may have just jumped over the point that you feel you've lost being comfortable, and you're all of a sudden scared shitless. So it's about imagine having your nose just pressing on the glass of a window frame, looking into a window. If you're miles away from the glass, you've got room. If you've broke your nose, you've obviously gone too far. So it's about just getting your nose on the glass, and that's that sort of, I'm happy with that now, and then deliver the throttle out.
That's not one of those glass windows in Macau where the girls sit on the other side with numbers on their wrists.
No, they're called goldfish bowls, dear.
Did you have your nose pressed up against one of those windows?
I was on the back row, scared to bloody death of coming down. It was terrifying.
Right, Paul Firth, he wants you to think about Croft and Pembrey. Can we wipe the board, please?
Sorry.
Croft and Pembrey, middle of the back straights at both Croft and Pembrey. The kinks in the middle of the back straight.
Croft and Pembrey. Oh, I know what you mean now, yeah.
In all honesty, can you take the kinks in the middle of the back straights at Croft and Pembrey flat chat on any bike with no more than 70 brake horsepower?
Oh, we're looking at that. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. The one at Pembrey, absolutely. I'm assuming that's the one just before at Pembrey, the just before Honda, I think it's called, which is the last corner. Yeah, generally, I've ridden a ZX9 there, a superbike ZX9, and you only had to roll back a bit going through the fast kink. Croft, not so sure. Croft, on a 70 horsepower bike, I'm assuming this is at the end of the sort of, as it were, the back straight, and it kind of goes left a bit, and then you brake and then turn right. And generally speaking, if the line is good, you can probably get through there no problem, flat stick. It's all having the confidence, can you get it stopped in time? To two very different corners, obviously very different situations. But generally speaking, if you're sub 70 horse, I would think yes is the answer to that. Yes before Honda. Certainly Pembrey. No problem at all. Absolutely flat knacker through there on a lot of bikes.
Mats Peterson, we've still got that photo in the cellar that he took on Alf's bike, because Matt says, I was watching that ZX9R race.
All right.
Do you remember Matt's took the photos on Alf's bike?
Oh, the big ones we blew up?
Yeah.
We got them in the cellar, Matt, so I'll have to take some photographs of your photographs of the thing we did. it was actually a really good bike, that. Very underrated. I mean, the R1 was out at the time, the first R1, and everybody jumped ship to the car from the Kawasaki straight to the R1. But I think the Kawasaki was had life in it. I mean, we're doing sub 59s round Pembrey on it, so it's, you know, it's motoring in the time.
Is that when it flooded in the corner?
No, that was.
Oh, that's on the OW1.
That was on the OW1. Yeah. Because Pembrey is one of them weird places. It's actually lower than sea level. So if it's been raining or the water table's high and the tide comes in, it just floods the track. And where it floods the worst is the Hairpin. And one was doing a race there, an endurance race, and it rained overnight, but the track was dry. The tide came in, and I think it was what they call a neap tide, so it was particularly high. And this puddle started to develop around the hairpin, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. So where everyone's going round and round, of course, it's an endurance race, you're out for hours. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger till eventually it got so big that a few people decided, I'm not going around there, I might as well drive through it. So people were driving through it, and of course that dragged water out onto the sort of the next little bit of a straight. So people were spinning up a high side in absolute chaos. But that's Pembrey for you.
Right, Peter says thank you. Something I'd like you to explain while we're waiting for some more questions.
All right.
It's the board clean, because I put the board there for drawing.
Okay. You know.
The difference between having a bump stop at the back of your seat and a tank extender.
Right, yes.
Because somebody misinterpreted something you said this week. Mm. You said that they were short in the body.
Yeah.
Because you can be 6'2" and still have a short body.
All right.
With long legs, can't you?
Yeah.
Or you can be 5'6" and have a really long body and short legs.
Do you want to draw it?
No.
Right.
I just would like you to explain, please, the difference between and the pros of having a tank extender or a bump stop.
Right, quick one. There's a bit of controversy, really, I think, about the tank extenders. Now, for anyone who doesn't understand, if you look at the bike from the side profile, as it were, that's the seat where you put your bum. You've got the bit which you're at the back where you've got your number board here. So that's the back of the seat. And then you've got the kind of the tank there. So this is the gap here, essentially, where
does
your bum goes
your camera?
In. Can you see that? Can we all see that? Hopefully. I'll actually lower it a bit just to make it a bit easier. So you've got the bit where your bum goes there. So this is the seat hump. You've got your seat. And then you've got the front of the tank here, which goes around. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, a tank extender essentially is a bit of sponge you can have, or the fancy ones with carbon fiber. And basically what they do is they extend the back of the tank. I think Matt Suzuki's got one, or had one.
Oh, what? The one from Jersey?
The one
did
from
it
Jersey.
Arrive?
The tank extender, which basically doesn't extend the tank in volume, but it extends the position where your testicles end up.
If you have testicles, everybody has them.
Now, a bump stop or a bum stop is a bit of sponge, some people, me, put on the back there. Now, the idea behind these things, from my perspective, is positioning where you essentially sit your bum. Now, when the bike's accelerating, obviously the bike's going that way, and when it's accelerating, it's forcing your weight going that way. So your bum wants to fall back. Now, if you've got nothing to support it, i.e. a bum stop, what tends to happen is to hold yourself in place, you end up hanging onto the bars with your hands, which can induce head shake and weaving and all sorts of issues coming out of the corner. Plus, because you're hanging on, it's like you're doing a pull-up, so you're burning energy, and you can quite quickly end up with the first start in of arm pump. So where you get the chance on the straights to relax, off a lot of people aren't relaxing because they're busy hanging onto the bike. So if you can hold yourself in position by a bump stop or a bum stop, finding its position is an important thing to do. And you have to do a little bit of experimentation. I have a standard measurement, for instance, from the centre of the headstock. You've got your two forks. Imagine looking at your top yoke. You've got your roughly that sort of shape. These are your forks, and that's your centre nut with the centre steering stem. From that point there to the back of the seat on my bike is 34.5 inches. And now I can go to whether it's a 125 or a super bike, and if I measure that, I know I kind of fit in the gap sort of thing. I feel comfortable. On a lot of super bikes, which are road-based ones, i.e., you know, your production stuff, the seat often is quite a long way back. Not that it's meant for two riders particularly, but there's no way on some bikes you can get your bum to the back there unless you lay almost prostrate. Suzuki's, the earlier Suzuki's were really bad for it. So from the steering stem to that, the back of the seat bump there where your bum sits, 34.5 inches. Now, finding out where that is good for you, it's all dependent on your arm length, body length, and what you feel like on the bike, a little bit to where your hands go on the bars as well. So there's a little bit of playing about to do. And that, for me, if I can come out of a corner, I kind of let my bum slide back into that, and I can open the throttle and basically relax my arms, and it helps to stop the head shake and so on. Now, the tank extension, a lot of people don't like sliding forward on the brakes, or they push themselves back on the bars to keep the weight back. I don't think if you had you, if even if you took the seat bump off and you sat on the rear seat unit, I don't think personally that's going to make that much difference than if you sat when you're braking right up close to the tank. And in fact, I like to be held up quite close to the tank, for instance, particularly in the braking area. I don't ever try and push myself back. So for me, the tank extension, I think maybe for people who are much, you know, really rangy, you know, you're 6 foot plus sort of people.
That's Matt.
Matt's, for instance, who have got relatively long arms, relatively long bodies, and that allows them to get their bum more naturally, will be further back in the seat. So, for instance, for argument's sake, if you're 6 foot two, three, four, you might want to take that to say, 38 inches or 36 inches, whatever, move it further back. And to stop you sliding forward, you might find it comfortable to have that tank extender. Personally speaking, I don't need it, don't like it, and I don't see the point of them often. I think it's much more important coming out of a corner is not to be pushed back too far and end up hanging onto the bars. So that's your tank extender.
Thank you. You can have a wipe down on the board now, because we have another question from Mark Ellery. How do you find a good marker for where to aim when going into coppice at Donington?
That's a really tough one.
I can see the turning point, but I don't seem to find the apex till I've missed it.
Missed it or ran over it. I've done both. In all honesty, that's a tough one, because you can look, obviously, when you're going up towards coppice, it's kind of like you're going up a hill, so you've got a nice flat horizon you're kind of aiming for. You can obviously tell the track going up there is on the left and on the right, so you've got like a gap that you're kind of aiming for. But well before you see the apex, you must have committed to the corner, and that's when the curve, if you got it right, jumps out at you as you pop over the rise. And if your knee clips the curve, happy days. If you run over it with your tyres, not good. And if you run 6 feet away from it, that's not good either. So before you get to the tipping point, or as you're approaching the tipping point, ideally, if you can look across slightly to the right of the track now and try and identify something. In all honesty, hand on heart, I really don't know what I look for. I think for me, it's more of, I've done so many laps there, I kind of just know this is the time to do it, and a point in the track when I'm going to do it, and how fast you do it. Because, of course, how fast you tip in there determines how fast you cross the track, which can determine your trajectory when you get towards the apex of the corner. If you don't tip in very fast, that means you're going to miss the apex by miles. If you tip in super fast, you might hit the apex. So it's all about the point that you tip in and the speed that you tip in. To help you, I really could not help you in that respect. You can look for things like flag posts, edges of bridges, if there's anything there. I think it's too early for the, well, it's not gone now, the Dunlop Bridge anyway. So,
black and white day.
In the black and white day. But it's anything pre-turn in. As you said, just before you drop the bike over, try and find something. Obviously, the other side, there won't be hardly anything, because the track's so bland on the inside, there's nothing really that you can visually see at that point. So it has to be something in the distance that you aim for. But by the time you've tipped in and you're starting to make your way towards the apex, whatever that thing was in the distance will have moved out of line. So don't, you know, you have to sort of get it right at commitment and then stick to your line and base that thing in the distance working on how fast you've turned in and how fast you're going. And the sort of the three come together, they merge kind of together. I hope that helps.
All right, we have another question now from Giovanni.
Giovanni, hello, fella, how are you?
He says, when you're looking at a new track or race bike, are the pros and cons of either prepping up a low mileage used road bike with all the race trimmings on it, or buying a used race bike in good condition? So would you buy a used road bike that's got all the bells and whistles on it, or would you buy a used race bike?
Personally speaking, I'd probably go down the road bike route, and then you can spend your money. And you see, what a lot of people do is they buy stuff and they fit stuff to the bike, which they're told to fit, and they'll gain very, very little
Well,
out of it.
Track Day Addict says they should
Or
fit.
track that it's get it fit. You know, it's mandatory. You've got to have this, you've got to have that, you've got to have the other. A lot of it is bollocks. It depends on ultimately where you want to take the bike to. And if you're racing the bike, you can't sort of give away stuff. So if you've got the opportunity, even though I'm a big believer in standard suspension, you can go very fast on it, ultimately it's not quite as good as race suspension.
When you're
So
looking for lap record
when
stuff.
you're looking for lap record type of stuff, so certainly suspension is something you want to look for. But that's what you've opened a whole box of worms there, really, because of you know, setup, servicing, maintenance, and all that you've got to dial into it.
But
But
quite often.
I would tend to go down the route, certainly if it was track day with a bit of racing, I would tend to go down the buy a road bike and convert it to your specification. Ultimately, you know, whether it's a super sport bike or a super bike that you're building, you can spend an awful lot of money on them. I mean, like a super sport bike, you can quite easily, you know, be sort of 20 to 30K to get a top flight one, where you wouldn't go that much faster on it than having, you know, a heavily or well, light to heavy modified road bike, you know, with suspension. Get rid of some weight off it, you know, keep the standard wiring harness, just blank off the stuff that you don't use. But you can sort of build your own bike to your own sort of spec, as opposed to sit on something. I've had people, I've coached people they've bought a super bike, which Joe Bloggs has done a 29 round Cadwell Park or something on, and we're struggling to do 39s. And the guy's really struggling to ride it because the problem with setup when it comes to particularly like race suspension, if you're not riding it not as it should be, but as it could be, the settings might not be anywhere near what you have or need. You can look at it the other way with road suspension. You kind of to when you go really fast, you're almost at the end of its adjustability before you kind of get there. But if it was me, I would go down the road bike route and build your own to your own specification. If you're not either capable or you haven't got the time or the space or availability, where you're basically just gonna have to go and buy something then. My worry about buying a race bike is you really don't know what you're buying at the end of the day unless you've got. The only way to do it, to be honest, is when I rode for V&M in the 90s. At the end of the season, the last race of the year, there was people literally with big fat wallets waiting. The bikes crossed the line, went into Parc Fermé. They wheeled the bike out of Parc Fermé, having given Jack Valentine a wedge of cash. That's the only way to buy, I think, a race bike, because you can guarantee it's just done that, so I can go and do it.
Don't let it go cold in between.
Because I've heard stories, horror stories of people who have bought that bike, I just want to service it for you, and it all of a sudden comes back with a different engine and Christ knows what. So, if you've bought a road bike, you've got more knowledge of that because you're kind of building into it. There's advantages, disadvantages. It's which way do you want to jump, really?
And the other thing is stuff like shocks and forks. You don't know what's inside them, and it only takes one little shim or something if somebody's not put it back together, because you don't know when it was last serviced if you've just bought
Yeah,
it.
well, again, it's the thing which it winds me up is people don't spend enough time when it comes to servicing bikes, is looking at things like suspension. I mean, I've got an old R1, a 2006 R1, and when I last rode it, about a year before when I last rode it, I had the suspension serviced. It's now been sat in the garage for 5 years. It's nothing wrong with it, it's perfect. But I know for a fact, before I ride it, I'll take the suspension out and get it serviced. It's just not worth chasing a problem that servicing can cure.
Not if you've gone all the way to the track and spent hundreds of pounds getting there and everything, and the track day to find that it's not. Peter's asking technical questions.
Peter is he?
Do you weigh the front end and rear end of your bikes
Weigh them?
to calculate the front rear weight bias?
No. It is what it is, Peter. I don't think see there's a point in doing that, to be honest. It's all about how the bike feels at the end of the day, what it weighs at the front and what it weighs on the back. You can't change that very much anyway. I mean, technically you can take the slide the swinging arm the rear wheel further back in the swinging arm slot essentially, and that will give you, it will put slightly more weight on the front wheel. The reality is you can't change it, so there's not much point in weighing it, I don't think.
So what about that story we heard when you were testing for Enfield about the dead badger on the tank? We couldn't make the bike handle, could
we? Yeah, ultimately it does make a difference, the weight distribution of a bike. I mean, I was testing a few years ago now the 650 Enfield Twin in its very early days, and the bike generally was pretty good. Harris had made the frame, and it was very nimble and really good, but it had a really weird head shake in certain situations, and they wouldn't release it or take it to the next stage until we cured this problem. So we went to Spain for 9 days, and we drove around all over the place, and we changed everything, trying to stop this thing, and we couldn't. And one of the testers had heard a story about a dead badger. Now let me finish about this one. And what he'd done, this guy, is he'd found apparently a dead badger on the side of the road and wanted to take it back home, Christ knows what for. So he put it on the tank of his bike up near the headstock and kind of held it there with his knees while he's riding along. And the bike handled much more different than it was before. And all it was moving weight front to back, moving the bias about. So if this is what you're getting at, Peter, yes, it moving weight can make a difference, but in general terms, unless you're going to have a big lump of weight and move it around on the bike, which is quite impractical.
Well, that's what we did with Enfield. We found an ironmonger and bought some lead, didn't we?
Yeah, we bought a load of lead shot, got an inner tube, cut it up into sections, filled it with lead shot, and then we dropped these things on the headstock, taped it to the top of the tank, right up near the headstock, and then tried it. And after we put an awful lot of weight there, and it cured, completely cured, the stability issue. So what they had to do, and it was a nightmare, because they'd already commissioned the frames to start building them, and they had to reposition the engine. I think it was 30 millimeters further forward, which doesn't sound very hard, but when you've got effectively, like the oil cooler had to be moved, the exhaust had to be reshaped, they had to change the front mod. Oh God, it was a nightmare.
And they've got the factory in India all tooled.
And the factory in India were already producing frames, so it was a bit of a nightmare. But to answer your question, Peter, I don't see the point in it myself, because generally speaking, you can't do a lot about it.
Paul first says, "Have you missed my last question? I think it was something about going into Honda. Where's Honda?"
Peter, with the benefit of your experience, if you were just starting out now as a club racer, which class would you choose? Which class would I choose? Well, a classic I could afford at the end of the day. What you want to do, what my dad always used to say to me, is you have a wants list and a needs list. And your wants list is always bigger than your needs list, because what you need sometimes isn't that much. And what you want is always bigger than what your pockets are. So figure out basically what you can afford to ride. Now, obviously, your fixed costs are things like entries, driving to the meetings, entries to a point. The variable costs are things like how much fuel you're going to use, which isn't going to be that much different, to be fair. Tyres, running a superbike against running a TZR250, very different bill. So try and find something that you can afford to run to a point. Second thing is, try, if you want to be really competitive, try and pick a class that is quite well policed, or that the rules are set out that you can't manipulate them too much. Like your Mini Twins is a prime example of that, because it's heavily policed and the rules are quite firm and fixed. The opposite end to that is you go to a class like the Super Mono, which has only three rules: engine capacity, type of engine, i.e. not two-stroke, and a minimum weight. After that, there are no rules, so there's no argument about cheating. You've just got to build a perfect bike then, so you'd start turning into checkbook racing. But basically, pick a class that you can afford to run in. When I first started racing, obviously started in production class, because it was basically a road bike and I went riding on the road. And for my first 2 years, I used to make a note of everything I spent on the bike, crash damage, fuel, this, that, and the other. I was making a budget. Halfway through the second year, I stopped doing it because I realised I was just feeding a black hole, and that was doing it cheaply. So picking a class you can afford is hard work, shall we say. But the main thing, Paul, is whatever class you're riding, is just enjoy it at the end of the day. I see people pouring money into racing, and even track days.
They don't laugh very much, do they?
Pouring money into it. And you sort of ask them, are you enjoying it? And they're almost not, because, you know, they've put so much into it. You know, effort is one thing, but finance is another. And it's a monkey on your back if it's, you know, too big. So make sure you enjoy it. Make sure you can afford it. Any more questions? Are we all buggered up? No, there we go. No, I didn't miss your question, Paul.
No, was that Paul's question?
That was Paul's question, yes.
He asked something about Honda, but is that at Croft?
That was Croft, and that was actually Pembrey, next to last corner at Pembrey.
You really like Pembrey, don't you?
I wish it was closer, Pembrey. It's just such a...
Can you draw it on there for me? Show people that you can draw it from memory.
The sphincter muscle of the universe to get to, it really is. Pembrey,
start, finish straight
into a hairpin, short, straight up to a right, left, and then there's three lefts which take you to effectively quite fast right down to, they call it a hairpin, but it's actually two little kinks, and then you fast run down the start, or down the back straight as it were, right through that kink we're talking about, and then a long right onto this straight.
Where's the cafe?
So that's Honda. The cafe's here, and you come onto the circuit there, and these three lefts here, that one, all them are awesome. I think they've put another section of the track on here, whether it's for cars or that, I don't know. But I really rate Pembrey from a riding point. It's a lot of fun, and a really enjoyable place. Pretty safe. I mean, you have to do something really stupid to hurt yourself there. But Pembrey result, it's just...
Can you draw me a map of Mallory now, please?
I don't want to draw a map of Mallory.
Come on, you're not allowed to be prejudiced.
No. Mallory, it's got a pond in the middle of it. That tells you something.
Who do you know that's been in the pond and got into trouble for that?
Loads of people.
Over the years.
I nearly got evicted from an event, a British Championship event, because I went onto the island, because in the centre of the pond there's a bit of an island, and they used to have like a weird greenhouse thing on there. And the guy who owned Mallory at the time, Chris, can't think of his second name, multi-millionaire, he or somebody spotted me with my two kids. Wandered over the little bridge and was sort of walking around looking at this greenhouse thing. Anyway, this car came screeching.
Like a biosphere.
And this car came screeching up, and this guy was effing and blinding. So I tore a strip off him for effing and blinding in front of my children, and it turned out to be the owner of the circuit. So it was a bit of a faux pas. So I was dragged in front of the clerk of the course, and had to grovel for my place the following day. So it stuck in my throat a bit, apologising, because I think he should have apologised to me, but... Hey, I didn't own the place.
Anyway, so come on, draw Mallory.
Oh, it's crap.
Some people really like Mallory.
Gerrards. Go down the start, finish straight. Big, long Gerrards. It's actually more than 180. Then you come into Edwina's, which is a little chicane. Short run into the S's, through the S's, down to the hairpin, round the hairpin, through the bus stop, round the elbow, onto the start, finish straight. It's just about that straight. Just about that shape.
Did they give you another colour pen? You could mark on it all the places you've crashed at Mallory over the years.
My oil cooler blew off going down the start finish straight, and as I tipped in, I basically went straight on into the barrier. Well, the bike did. Very second hand. I lost the crash there. I've high sided coming out. Never crashed going to Edwina's. Because last time I raced there, there was no Edwina's. A high-sided going in between the right and the left. A high-sided coming out the left, crashed at the hairpin. I've crashed going into the bus stop, and I've high-sided coming out. So just about everywhere, really.
Paul says, if you could take just one British track and move it somewhere where it's lovely and warm, like the Spanish climate.
Yeah, which one?
Which one British track would you take and export to the Spanish climate?
That's pretty mean, that, Paul, really.
Can you imagine all the foreigners going somewhere as narrow as Cadwell?
No, they wouldn't believe it. You remember that American who came across the race in the Harley Championship and he stood at the top of the mountain and says, "Where's the circuit?" He said, "That's it." And his jaw, the mechanical clankers, his jaw at the floor. It's very funny.
And the Bahrainis.
Oh, yeah.
I saw their tracks at F1 tracks and they came to get coached.
They couldn't believe it either, too.
With grass on the side of the track.
Yeah, what's that? It's grass. Oh, right. Which track, Paul? Well, not very often talked about track. I absolutely love riding there, which is Thruxton. Ulton Park, Cadwell Park have all got the bits which you like and it's all nice, da 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 da. But I'm more of a big fan of really ballsy, really fast stuff. I love going really fast at big angle of lean and moving about. To be honest, on really fast tracks with really fast sweepers and that, you don't do much high siding. You do a lot of losing the front end. But because the wheels are going so fast, the centrifugal force helps to stop the high sides. You get big moments, of course, but you don't often high side. Not that I'm using that as an excuse, but I just love Thruxton. It's fast, ballsy. I hope they never resurface it because it's bumpy. It's just thrilling. If you sanitize a circuit, you know, too much and you make it really safe and really smooth, people just go faster. And I don't see the point of it. I'm not suggesting you should have dangers on a circuit, but they sometimes, I mean, for instance, the last time I went to the Northwest 200 was pre-chicane days. There's no chicanes back in them days. And Mathers Cross, which was a very fast right-hander, and then you went over a crossroads straight across it, was 145, 150 mile an hour on a super sport bike. He literally just rolled it off in top, back of gear. By the time he got to the apex, you're flat out in fifth, and it's a tall fifth at that. Now, of course, you've got the chicane there. Problem was, if you fell off at Mathers Cross, it was a big crash. And unfortunately, there was a lot of people didn't walk away from it. So, but that, I think you've got to respect those corners as opposed to sanitize them. You know, racing is dangerous. You can never, on the safest, if you had a drag strip, doesn't mean it's going to be safe. It's safer than putting a bend on it, obviously. But I think the element of danger and fear is a very important part of it. So to answer your question, Thruxton probably. Next after that would be probably Ulton, because I just really love Ulton. I just wish they'd get rid of Hizzy's chicane. It's such a shit chicane. And again, what was it called beforehand? I forgot what the corner was called now. End of the back straight, and then you went over Clayhill. Whatever it was called, I can't remember what it's called. It was a fantastic corner. But unfortunately, because of where the pond was on the other side, they couldn't move the banking any further back. So from a safety perspective, and I think it was car orientated, they put the chicane in, and that's all she wrote.
You like Knockhill though, don't you? It's just so far to go to. It's better than Mallory, surely.
It's considerably better than Mallory. And if you fancy going up to Knockhill, what they do at Knockhill, on particularly the weekend track days they run there, is on the Saturday or the Sunday, whichever, they turn the circuit round. So you race round one way one day, round the other way, or reverse way round on the following day. Interesting. From my point of view, I've done both and found running the other way around was absolutely horrendous. So scary, it was untrue.
That's only because it wasn't what you were used to and your brain was trying to run it the other way.
You could get it wrong so easy.
But they ran Misano the other way.
Yeah, but they altered Misano. Misano, I ran the anti-clockwise way when they first run it. Awesome track. And then they turned it round. Why, God knows. So you go down the back straight at Misano now, and there's three right-handers in ever-decreasing radiuses. So you're basically going, trying to scrub speed off all the way through them. And I think it's really dangerous. Where coming the other way, you came round a tight left, and they basically opened out. So you're kind of accelerating all the way through them. And it's a fantastic section. So, but I don't understand why they do it. I really don't.
In the olden days, didn't they run Brands Hatch the wrong way?
They used to have a race right at the end of the year. Race of the year or something like that they called it, and they'd run it backwards then. But again, safety standards in them days were like very questionable. They didn't have a pit lane. They literally just pulled up at the side of the track.
They weren't wearing back protectors or body armour. Bugger all.
Yeah, not good. Not good. Right.
Have we got something else to draw? I like drawing.
I don't like drawing. I hate drawing.
Right. Design me a perfect racetrack.
No. What do you mean, no? No, it's impossible because you've got to think of gradients and stuff like that.
Well, do you want some straights? Do you want some long sweeping corners?
No, I'm not getting paid enough for that. That's a massive undertaking. I mean, what do you think? Design your own circuit.
On there.
No, you just sort of say it's a combination of this, that and the others. Almira, you know, if you drew Almira, you'd say it's great. Not for me. I don't like it. I like Andalusia miles better. And a lot of people don't like that, so it's a...
Do they all like Almeria because it's like the UK track?
No, that's Cartagena. Cartagena, to me, is like Brits Abroad
draw
track.
Cartagena for me.
Cartagena. It's a hard track to draw, Cartagena. No, I'm not drawing. I'm not doing any more drawing. Well, not circuits, anyway.
We need people to ask you questions. That you
Come
can
on,
draw.
Some questions, please.
Draw some diagrams of them.
Yeah. It's put me on the spot a little bit, asking me a question, but... I don't mind us answering if I can, that is. Cascades, going back to that Cascades thing. It is a tough one to get right for a start off, but
what your confidence through Cascades?
The corner itself and confidence. It's one of those ones you've got to get it right, you've got to be sort of uber confident with what you can do with the front of the bike. If you're not happy at corner entry, particularly on high speed stuff. It's really weird. This it's like you've got to get used to it. So you've got to build a strategy to sort of build yourself up to it, to getting used to it. For instance, a lot of people who come to us and say, "I'm not very good on left-handers." Now I don't know whether that's because most UK circuits or most circuits are clockwise, so there's going to be generally speaking fewer left-handers than there are right. Maybe that's it. I don't know. But often when I'm following people who don't like left-handers, they're actually not sitting on the bike quite as they would going around a right-hander. So to them, the feel of what's going on is slightly different than it is through a right. And I think there's so much of riding a bike which is about feel, that if you're not replicating what you do to the right, to the left, it's bound to be different for you. But if you don't like left-handers, I would suggest...
Go to Rockingham!
Can't die, sorry. Full of dodging cars, is go to a circuit which has lots of left-handers on it. And for me, the only one to go to is Sachsenring. I know it's a long drive for everybody. Awesome track, really quite short. I think it's the shortest Grand Prix track on the market. But what a track, absolutely fantastic. You can learn the left-handers for one. The thing which it also generates is lots of angular lean for a long time. I mean, from turn two to turn 12, the bike is going left, 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 left. They're all lefts. It's just an incredible track, with, you know, massive lean. And me Gen 3 BMW did some really good laps around there. And when I came back in, me left and right angle sensor was 64 degrees round the left and 63 round the right. So he's absolutely on its side.
I think you got a sweat on, didn't you?
I had a sweat on that day. It was 36 degrees, like.
You couldn't think who designed something as horrendous.
Something as hard work, yeah. It was tortuous. But again, a lot of people don't like it because it's hard to learn. And again, I don't understand that. You know, if you don't like tracks which are hard.
People want a challenge. They want to go on a holiday. They want to ride the bike round and they want to come home.
Yeah, but for me, half of the battle is, you know, mastering, getting on top of it and facing your fears, as it were.
Paul says, have you ever been to Blighton?
Blighton, no, Paul. Airfield circuit, as far as I know.
Near Gainsborough.
Yeah, I think that's where Cole took Ron.
Yes, he did.
But no, I've never been. Couldn't tell you much about it.
Which UK tracks have the best cafes? Asking for a friend. Well,
Snetterton.
It's the staff that make the cafe.
Yeah, definitely the staff, I think, make the cafe. Mallory used to have a really good cafe there. All the stuff was homemade. When it's gone sort of thing. And it was great. The old girls behind the counter, they were rum as buggery. Don't know. I've not been for so long now. I don't know what it's like. Of the MSV circuits, our favourite is Snetterton. And again, that's largely because of the staff there. The food, the standard of the food, I think, is very good.
It's expensive though, but
It is,
you
but
know.
you know, you're caught. It's not bad.
Captive audience.
Captive audience.
But if they smile at you and chat to you while they take the money off you, it's a
Yeah.
scam, isn't it?
Cadwell Park, for instance, the staff in the cafe at Cadwell Park.
Ooh, behave yourself
Oh,
now,
for
Mike.
God's sake. They just like, it's been slapped on a
Stop.
regular basis.
Yes, Mark says Pembrey does great food, and it
Pembrey,
does.
yeah. Pembrey, yeah. Forgot about, again, it's been years since I've been to Pembrey. Again, it's privately owned. I can't, what's his name?
Phil.
Yeah,
Phil
Phil.
Am. Is it Phil?
Not Phil Arms, Phil, yeah, he owns a circuit. And it's really family run. And I think you see that in a lot of what the activity there, but
Now you're forgetting what I like at Castle Coombe.
cider. Yeah, cider at Cadwell Castle Coombe. Yeah, Jennifer got drunk on it once. Yeah, it was quite
There were
fun. That
no
was a
labels
funny
on it,
evening
they were
that.
just plastic containers,
It, yeah,
weren't
it was 5 gallon drums of wobbly drums with no labels, totally homebrew, rocket fuel. 2 pints of that and you are
they? It
mullered.
was delicious.
Absolutely mullered.
Mind you, Ray Cowles gave me poutine at Brands Hatch once, and I remember dancing. The only problem was there was no music.
Yeah,
Phil Bevan.
drug Phil Bevan. Yeah, Phil Bevan. But yes, cafes makes a lot of difference.
Knock Hill used to do Scotch pies.
Yeah, it was, yeah, Knockhill, yeah. But to be honest, we don't go to the cafes when we're there, but
You're an athlete, you have to have a diet, can't you?
yeah, usually I'm on a diet halfway through the year. I mean, some of the stuff which is, pastry and gorgeousness. It used to be a bugger when we used to go to Oulton Park and we'd have breakfast in the morning and we'd just basically go for porridge. Two reasons. One, they gave you an enormous amount, so we get one and split it between us. It was superb porridge, though, really, really tasty and very cheap. So that's what we used to go for.
Inexpensive, I prefer.
Cheap. Yes.
So what about Anglesey talking about Welsh tracks? As a track.
Anglesey, I quite enjoyed the last corner onto the start finish straight. I really think they need to do something about it. It's not a negative camber, it's so flat it gives like an awkward sort of sensation. They could just put a tiny bit of redressing and put a bit of a camber on it. I think that'd cure the job.
We've been in some wind and rain there, though, haven't we?
Yeah, I did a track day there quite a few years ago, and it rained overnight and rained all the way through the day, more or less. And you looked out up from the pit lane, and it was just a lake. You couldn't tell where the track finished and the grass started. It was just horrendous. And the none of the instructors would go out. So the track day organizer says, "Mike, would you go have a run round and see how what's the conditions are like?" So I went out on the ZX10 with wet weather tires on. Did one very slow lap and came in and basically said, "Not a hope." And it was just waterlogged basically. But yeah, that was grim, grim. And of course, there
Strange.
was a wind, a 100 mile an hour wind blowing, which doesn't make it much easier either.
It's strange because when we were in Bahrain and it rained, the Bahrainis asked you to go out because nobody had got any experience in the rain at all.
No, yeah, it rained. It well, went did it did that Ducati series and it rained not a lot. And to be honest, by the time it was time to go out, if they'd have just got on with it, it would have been dry more or less. But they buggered about something shocking and made me go out. And I sort of said, "Yeah, by the time we all line up, it'll because it was drying really fast, it would have been all right. Just tell everyone to go steady." But if you spit on the track, to them, it's raining.
And the opposite to rain, of course, is sand, which can be just as slippery.
Yes.
And it's not just in the Middle East,
No.
it's at Estoril.
Estoril at I fell off at Jerez. I saw this twig blowing across the track, and I thought, "Oh, it's a bit windy," and instantly fell off. And I thought, "It's the wind brought me off." And then I stood up, and you could just see it well, see it, feel it on the track. So yeah, circuits with elevation like Almeria also. Because of the elevation, you get a bit of wind, and if it's windy, one of the things you should be looking for there is sand being blown across the track, and any debris, detritus, anything going across the track, that's a good indication that there's other stuff there, including sand. So be careful.
Peter's asking about grip. Which UK tracks have the best grip in the wet?
not Donington. Snetterton, for me, is one of the worst tracks in the wet. Just awful. Brands isn't bad. Most of the circuit, apart from Graham Hill Bend, which is, again, horrendous. I don't know what that's about. So which is the best track?
Isn't there a spring as you come out of Druids that runs across the track? You crashed the Ducati there, didn't you?
No, it was a spring coming out of the ground in the middle of the track. They've sorted that out now. They patched it. So which track has the best wet weather grip? Ulton, I would say, is pretty good grip. But again, there's a couple of corners. Druids can be a bit tricky. But I think Ulton's pretty good in the wet. Temperature makes a huge difference, of course. If it's warm and wet, it's a hell of a lot different when it's cold and wet. But best one, I mean, Thruxton. Not that hardly anybody goes to Thruxton. Thruxton's awesome in the rain. Fantastic, fantastic grip.
Anglesey, everyone, you know, you can ride that.
Anglesey was all right, yeah. I thought Anglesey was pretty good in the rain. There's only a few tracks which I would advise extreme caution on, and those are Snetterton, mostly the infield section, and Brands, a little bit careful going into Paddock Hill. And then mainly, the main one is Graham Hill at bottom after Druids. That's awful in the rain.
Remember in the olden days, they just used to pile up there at the bottom.
Oh, big heaps of people, yeah.
They used to stand at the back of the pits to see who actually made it round the corner.
Yeah, who's gone first, yeah. But mind you, it was a lot longer, faster corner then, so it was arguably slightly better. But when you leave Brands, when you leave the Indy circuit and go out to the GP circuit, the GP circuit's fabulous grip. I think mainly because it's not used as much. So I think the abrasiveness is still there in the tarmac. I think it must get polished with grip, with rubber, and all the edges kind of get taken off it. It's often when they resurface a track, it kills the tyres because it's all like a fresh nail board. It's all sharp and ready to rock. But best one, I would probably say Ulton. Anglesey, I'd say Anglesey is pretty good as well. Yeah. And I thought, forgot about Anglesey.
Let's talk about some international tracks. Barber, because Peter's in the States, isn't he? Hmm. What did you think about Barber Motorsports track?
The Barber event I went to, yeah, that was a really interesting track. Lots of elevation changes, which I enjoyed. It's just been resurfaced. I say just, we're a year, I'm a year out of date, but it's been resurfaced not long ago. Because it used to be three strips going all the way around, and where the strips joined, there was like bitumen and infill, and it was a little bit shitty in places. But the track itself was awesome. When they resurfaced it, they used a special tarmac layer machine, which was one width and enormous, like they did with the one in Texas.
Circuit of America.
They made it in one go, basically, one strip all the way around. So there's no seams.
Well, anywhere. They're supposed to do that at Silverstone, ready for MotoGP, but all sorts of things went wrong.
Oh, the shit hit the fan there, yeah, if you can remember that. Nightmare.
A bit like Rockingham in the old days when the BSB went there. And they said you can't have that, the white lines, and yeah. Then they had to take them off.
To take all the white lines off, yeah. They painted, you used paint as opposed to paint and grit. So it was particularly slippy.
When you're running around Macau, do you notice where the white lines are and the taxi ranks and things on the road?
Since I've been there, love.
No, but it's paint on the road, isn't it?
Well, when I did Macau, again, a lot of years ago, there's obviously a road circuit, so wherever there was a junction, there was loads of painted lines and that, and it was for certainly the first day's practice. You could not go fast at all because it was polished as it was like a tabletop. It was horrendous. So they started to burn the plastic effectively. What it is, they burn it off. I don't know whether they do it now, but generally it wasn't good at all.
Well, it doesn't rain much, really, does it? Over there, they have a monsoon.
But when it does, nobody goes out. No, or you strip off and have a shower. One of the two.
Mm-hmm. It's nearly time to watch snooker.
Yes, I'm going to watch some snooker now. So I hope people have enjoyed me droning on.
The nice thing is Higgins is like an old timer who's coming back, isn't he?
Yes. Well, not coming back, but he's in the height of his game. And so I fancy watching that.
That's something you should discuss. Is age really a factor?
Is it related?
That prevents you from being successful? Because it's not bothering Higgins, is it?
If you're a weightlifter, if you're an old bloke, I suppose it makes a difference. Or running a marathon. But certainly snooker, I can't see it being an issue.
And are you slowing down? That's what people would ask.
I'm probably not as fast as I used to be in absolute pace. But I've learned so much. I feel I can go at a very fast pace for a lot longer and manage my resources, as it were. That's why I love endurance racing so much. But to a point, age shouldn't be a barrier. The one thing youth gives you is lack of fear.
Enthusiasm.
And enthusiasm, yeah.
So thank you to all the patrons, of course.
Yes, of course. Without your help, people, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. So many thanks for your contributions and support. And hopefully I'll carry on and I'll be doing lots more videos and stuff and keep everyone informed.
We just can't get out and do anything.
Yeah, we're knackered at the moment. We can't go anywhere and do stuff. So it's a bit of a nightmare. But as soon as we can, there's going to be a glut of videos and a glut of information coming, including the weight transfer thing, which I've been meaning to get to try and do, but I want to do it properly in the proper environment. And I've got something in my mind, but I can't get there at the minute. And that'll cause a lot of intrigue and hopefully loads of questions.
But if people like this format of your question and answer, I'm say on a weekend, you could do another one.
Yeah. But I certainly don't mind doing this Q&A thing. And if that helps people, fine. You have to put up with me babbling on, fair comment. But as long as I can answer your questions. And the more questions, the better, because it kind of helps to keep the ball rolling a bit. So anyway, I'm off to watch me snooker now.
It's right, it's 4-0.
I hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll speak again another time. Thanks very much, guys.
Bye.
Bye. If you end this live video now.